Sorry about that, guys. Hey, one of the things that we do here is we do this live. And one of the reasons why we do this live is so that we can do this as a community. And so we're so grateful for you guys to join us here this morning as we just worship our Lord on this Easter morning. So let me just start off by asking you this question. What is the first thing that comes to your mind if I mention the name John Logie Baird? Let me guess. Probably one or two things. It's either nothing, or two, who in the world is John Logie Baird and why does it even matter? Well, the British think very highly of this man. In fact, the people of Great Britain rank him as the 44th most influential Brit in all of the history of Great Britain. That's some high praise coming from a country that's produced the likes of Winston Churchill, Queen Elizabeth I, Sir Isaac Newton, William Shakespeare, Geoffrey Chaucer, Oliver Cromwell, Stephen Hawking, Jane Austen, the Beatles. The names just go on and on. So why is he so special? In fact, some people would even say he's revolutionary. Well, let me give you kind of a hint. He played an absolute pivotal role for us having the ability to have this unique online Easter experience this morning. In fact, not just for us here, as you know, with River Run, but also with everybody all around the world who will be tuning into any worship service online or through the television, because John Logie Baird was the man who invented the television. In fact, you can thank Mr. Baird for all the TV screens that you have in your home. And so, back in the early days of television, TV was very small, it was very crude, and when you looked through the lens, all you could see was a black and white picture, or more accurately, a grayscale picture. But back in those days, people didn't care. They loved their TV, and black and white or grayscale was all that they knew. They didn't know there was anything better, and so it just kind of became normal. And so that was just kind of how life was. They didn't know that there was anything else but a black and white type of TV. Well, way before John Logie Baird, there was another revolutionary. And you probably guess who I'm talking about. That's right, Jesus of Nazareth. Well, when Jesus came on the scene, he came into the world where people looked at life and God through a lens by which all they could see was black and white. They could see things, but they could not see all the things that they were meant to see. They saw things in a very crude and small way. But they didn't know any better. They were pretty content with that. They didn't know that there was anything better than that. And so they just kind of went on as life thinking that way as very normal. Okay? It was something that was given to them by their generation before them. And so they held on to it. And it was something that they passed on to the other generation because, again, that's all they knew. In fact, 2,000 years later, that same grayscale thinking is pervasive even in our culture and around the world even to this day. That we tend to look at life through a lens by which we only see grayscale. We see things, but we don't see all the things that we were meant to see. And oftentimes we don't even recognize it or know it because it's so ingrained to us because it was just given to us. And so Jesus, as a revolutionary, and like all revolutionaries, was all about change. Changing our perspective and changing our thinking away from a grayscale type of thinking. But what is grayscale thinking? Well, grayscale thinking can simply be put this way. I am the lens by which life has its meaning, and all that I see is all that there is. It's kind of bifocal. There's two lenses. The first lens is I am the lens by which life has its meaning. In other words, life and meaning and God and everything is all filtered through me. I'm the center of the universe. So anything that deals with meaning or purpose finds its way through me. Okay? But there's some byproducts to that. First of all, there's pride and ego goes through that because, you know, I'm my own universe and meaning and purpose is found through me. There's also jealousy that maybe somebody else has a better universe than me. And there's also a flip side to that. There's shame and depression and the thinking that maybe my universe isn't all that big and isn't all that great. And then there's the other part of the bifocal, that other lens that we tend to think in, you know, through with life is all that I see is all that there is. That everything that I see must be all that there is. Everything that I can understand, everything that I conceive must be all that there is. And everything that I can see must be all that there is. What does that mean? That means we tend to look in the lens of this is all that we have in this world. This is our own life, right? This is all we got. And this tends to kind of go into the background of our thinking and the way that we go about life. And so there's two byproducts of that. There's a byproduct of greed, since this is my own life and this is all that I have. I got to get all that I can for me. And then there's the other aspect of it is, if this is all there is of life, then there creates inside of me anxiety and fear because of my own mortality. Do I have cancer? Do I have the virus? Oh no, what's going to happen to me? Is this it? Is this all? Is this the end of it all? Because all that I see is all that there must be, and so this must be it. And so with this lens of thinking, we tend to have pride and shame and depression. We also tend to have greed. We tend to have fear and anxiety. This becomes a very natural thing within us. It can be very easy for us as well as followers of Christ. If you're a follower of Jesus Christ, you could inadvertently, not even knowing, that you go to church, read your Bible all the time, and hear the words of God and filter all of those through a grayscale thinking. In fact, we do it a lot. And sometimes we don't even recognize it. And this is a true statement here, is that even Jesus' own teachings, just his teachings alone, do not change our grayscale thinking. What do I mean by that? Well, let me give you an example of this from Jesus during his ministry. You can see even with his followers, they spent many years with Jesus. They spent many days with Jesus. But every time they heard things from Jesus, they kept filtering it through that old grayscale lens of theirs. And so let me give you an example. There was a time when Jesus' ministry was really beginning to take off. He was really popular. He was doing things that were just really messing with people's minds. And so everybody was flocking to hear this amazing man. And obviously, those who were hanging out with him kind of felt that residual of being around Jesus. That since Jesus is special, we must be special because we're part of his inner circle. So we must be pretty great. That's grayscale thinking, okay? Well, let's look at this. In Luke chapter 9, verse 43, you can see it here. So when Jesus was doing these really amazing, miraculous things, people were just in awe. It says, awe gripped the people as they saw the majestic display of God's power. We love being around things that are majestic. We love being around things that are powerful. And we love connecting ourselves to those things because it makes us feel like a sense of significance. Have you ever name dropped before? You ever told people, hey, I know so-and-so, or I just met such-and-such? You ever done that before? We do that. It's kind of the way that we do because we think that by surrounding us by what we consider great people, that must make us great too. In fact, what you see is that Jesus doesn't think that way. Jesus doesn't think in grayscale. He looks and understands the world in a totally different way. Look at this here in the next part of verse 43. It goes on, he says, while everyone was marveling at everything he was doing, everybody was just sitting there gawking at him. Like, man, that's amazing. So while everybody's just sitting there thinking, he's incredible, he's great, this is amazing, at all the things he was doing, Jesus looks at his disciples and he says something to him. Now, what you see here is that Jesus, when he speaks some color into their life, okay? He speaks some truths that are big, that are bold, that are absolutely important. And this is what he says here in the next verse, in verse 44. He goes on, he says to his disciples, listen, all right? Listen and remember what I'm about to say to you. The Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of his enemies. So he says to him, listen and remember, all right? Because I'm going to tell you, I'm going to be betrayed and I'm going to be taken into the hands of enemies. In other places, he talks about how he's going to die and he's going to raise from life 3 days later. So he said, listen to me on these things. But look what happens next here in verse 45. What happens? What do they do? But they didn't know what he meant. In other words, they didn't understand what he was saying. And you say, wait a minute, how in the world did they not understand what he was saying? He seemed pretty, pretty clear. Now, it's clear to us because we live 2,000 years later and we're looking back in the corridor of time. But what they're doing is they're thinking about life in their grayscale lens. In their grayscale lens, they're thinking about, man, Jesus is great, he's amazing, he's going to change this world. He's going to bring about economic prosperity. He's going to bring about a powerful kingdom. And we're going to be right in the middle of it. And so this whole thing about death and all that must be some kind of parable that he's talking about, because that doesn't make sense through the lens by which I look at God and look at life by. Now, here's the point here. This is why Jesus' teaching doesn't necessarily change our lives. Because if we go through life with grayscale lenses, it doesn't matter how much color you're thrown your way. It doesn't matter how bright, how vibrant the colors are. You're not going to see any of it. Because all you're going to do is process everything through the grayscale. And that's exactly what they did. They processed everything through them being the center of their own world. And all that there is all that they can see. And so they couldn't understand it. And they were afraid to ask him about it, all right? But what you see here is even though he's talking about his own death, you can see how it just didn't really compute to them. They were still fixated on the awe and wonder of this man and how powerful he is and what that means for their close proximity to him as far as their own greatness. Because right after this, look what they do in verse 46. Then... All right, right after this, then the disciples begin to what? They begin to argue. And what are they arguing about? Which one of them is the greatest? So they're murmuring to each other. Well, who do you think is greatest? Well, I think he likes me the most. Well, he spends more time with me, so it must mean I'm the one who's greater. And so he says all of these things, and it goes out, you know, through one ear and out the other. And they stay focused on the things that they're focused about, which is grayscale thinking. But they're the center of the world of their own greatness. And Jesus understood this. Jesus was very wise. It's the reason why he came into this world, because he understands our faulty thought process. He understands that we think in crude ways and small ways, and we look at things through an incomplete lens. We see some things, but we don't see all the things that we were meant to see. And that's why in the very next verse you see, says this in verse 47, but Jesus knew their thoughts. He knew what was going on inside of their minds. And so right after that, Jesus begins to teach them about what greatness really is. And ultimately, Jesus says that greatness is really putting yourself last. The least will be great. And you know what? I know what they didn't do. They didn't go, oh, and start living humbled lives. They began to just continue on as they kept on, you know, as they always have, because ingrained in them was this grayscale thinking. They're the center of their lives, and everything that they see is all that there is. And that is why when Jesus was arrested, they couldn't understand it. It was beyond their own comprehension of what was going on. It didn't make sense to how they were trying to make sense of God, meaning of life, and meaning of what is supposed to happen in this world. So when Jesus was arrested, they ran away. Look at Mark 14, verse 50. It says this. It says, then all his disciples, not one, not two, you know, not just three, all of them, every single one of them, because all of us go through life, whether we realize it or not, with this grayscale thinking. And so they all saw that Jesus was arrested, and so they deserted him and ran away. Why? Because if all that I see is all that there is, I'm going to be about self-preservation. I'm going to preserve my own life. And so when they saw that this powerful person was arrested, and now they're confused about it, and they know what that means with their own association with him, they run away. Self-preservation. And you see this all the way through these next couple of days, even when Jesus rose from the dead. They still couldn't quite understand what was going on. So Jesus was arrested. He was sentenced to death. And he was crucified, and they all watched him from very far away, and they watched him, and they saw him die. And then right after that, on that Saturday evening, some of the ladies went out to go buy some spices in order to give Jesus a very proper burial. And so Mark chapter 16, verse 1, it says this. It says, Saturday evening, when the Sabbath ended, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Salome, went out and purchased burial spices so they could anoint Jesus' body. Why did they go and buy, you know, these spices to anoint Jesus? They did it because through their lens, all that there is all they could see. They saw a man who died. And when you die, you're dead. And so they thought that now, since they weren't able to, when Jesus died, to go get the burial spices, they had to wait after the Sabbath to go do it. Now that it was time for them to be able to go do it, they went and bought the spices because they believed Jesus to be dead, right? Just like when anybody else dies and passes away, we pretty much think they're dead. And so they go, they buy these things, and so that the very next morning they can go and give Jesus a proper burial. And so in verse 2, it goes on and it says this. It says, so very early on Sunday morning, just at sunrise. So early that morning on sunrise, they didn't get up thinking that Jesus rose from the dead. They got up early in the morning thinking, we got to go to the tomb and give him the burial spices that he needs before his body begins to decay and stink. All right? And so they get up thinking that he's dead, and they went to the tomb. And on the way, they were asking each other, okay, who will roll away the stone for us from the entrance to the tomb? Because there's, you know, because that stone is still there, and there's a body still in there, because they believe that Jesus is dead, just like any of us would do that. And so it goes on in verse 4. They get up there, and then they realize, but when they arrived, they looked up, and they saw that the stone, which was very large, had already been rolled away, which creates a lot of confusion to them. Again, when the stone went away, they weren't automatically thinking, oh, well, he must have risen from the dead. Why? Why did they not think that way? Because that's not the way that they thought, because you don't see dead people raised from the dead. That's not something that you see every day. So they go in there and they see that the tomb is actually empty. And then they go away from that, kind of confused and wondering. And so they go back to the men, to the disciples, and they're in panic mode because they believe not that Jesus rose from the dead, but somebody took him. And so they go to them in John chapter 20, verse 2. They say to the disciples, they, who's they? We don't know exactly who they is. I don't think they know who they is, but somebody must have taken Jesus' body. So they have taken the Lord's body out of the tomb, and we don't know where they put him. So again, they're thinking that we saw him die, and so he's dead. And so the natural thing to think is if you go back to the place of burial and the body's not there, somebody must have taken him. And so there's a sense of panic. So what happened here? Who took it? Why did they take it? All of these things. And then you begin to see that the disciples, those who were with Jesus all those years and heard all those things that Jesus said, were very confused at that. In fact, in Luke chapter 24, verses 11 and 12, this is what it says. Peter then and the guys basically said this, but the story sounded like what? Nonsense to the men. So they didn't believe it. So some of you may have grown up in the church, or some of you may have never been to a church, and maybe this you stumbled upon this talk. And you may have thought that, you know what? Jesus raising from the dead, that's nonsense. That I don't believe it. If that's you, then you are in really good company, because it's exactly the way that Peter felt, that John felt, that James felt. If you ever go by a church and you see a church that says St. Peter or whatever, then recognize that there was a time where that guy felt like it was exactly nonsense, just like you. They didn't believe it. And so they didn't believe what they said. And so in verse 12, he goes on and he says, but however, Peter jumped up and ran to the tomb to look. So he's wondering, what in the world just happened to the body? Okay? And so stooping, he peered in and saw the empty linen wrappings. And then he went home again, thinking that everything's great, he rose from the dead. No. What did he do? Wondering what had just happened. So even in that moment, on that Easter moment, morning, they didn't believe that Jesus rose from the dead. And then later on in that afternoon, they all got together just in a place where they were hiding. And so in John, again, back in John chapter 20, verse 19, you kind of see this. And so that in Sunday evening, the disciples were meeting where? Behind locked doors. Why were they meeting behind locked doors? They were meeting behind locked doors because they were scared. They were scared of what the Jewish leaders may do to them, because of their association with Jesus. If Jesus was going to get crucified, more than likely the people who are part of that movement of his were probably going to get crucified as well. And so they locked themselves deep into some room in the vast expanse of Jerusalem, hiding out because they were scared and they were preserving their life, because they looked at life through the lens of what they've always known and thought, that what they see must be all that there is. But then something happened. And in that moment, in that evening, with all of them together, In the very next part of verse 19, we see this. Suddenly, Jesus was standing there among them. Now, think about this for a second. Standing in front of them was someone they were not expecting at all, because they believed that Jesus died. They don't know exactly what happened to his body, but they didn't think he was alive. And there he is, right there in front of them, behind this locked door with all of these guys, is standing a guy who they saw themselves dead. They witnessed it. They saw that. They assumed it. He was dead. And there he is in front of them. Completely rocked their paradigm of understanding that all that you can see must be all that there is. And there's another aspect of it too, that the man that's standing in front of them is also the man that they all ran away and ditched. It's also the one, as Peter's standing there in front of watching this man and seeing him right there, that was the man that he denied 3 times. In fact, he denied him so much and so harsh that he said, "Man, may curses come down from heaven if I know this man." And there he is, standing right in front of him. Now, Jesus in that moment gives a glimpse of something beautiful and something amazing. He says these words to them, "Peace be with you." And in that moment, everything changed. And they saw everything in color. They began to understand that in that phrase, "peace be with you," was a man who loved them, even though they ditched him. That even though that they were prideful and arrogant, he stooped down to the level of giving up his own life for them. They began to understand that maybe life doesn't revolve around them. The universe doesn't revolve around them, but maybe there's someone more special, more amazing, more powerful than them. And it's the man who loves them and says, "Peace be with you," who's standing right in front of them. And maybe there's something more than just this world. Maybe there's something more than what I can see. At that moment, they understood a real principle, that seeing a dead man alive and a dead man who's alive love them unconditionally colors everything. The resurrection colors everything. It colors the way that we think about love and life and purpose and meaning when we see it through the eyes of Jesus Christ and his love. It changes everything when we recognize that there is hope for life and eternal life in us. And so Jesus at that moment gives them another lens to look at, a way to look at life through color. And so look at this next point here, that this is the idea of color thinking. This is how we are to think, that Christ's love is the lens by which life has its meaning, and all that I see is not all that there is. That the way that we see life in all its fullness and all its colors, not through us, is through Jesus Christ. And more importantly, through the love of Jesus Christ. And that is what they begin to really experience there. When Jesus said, "The least will be greatest," they saw it right there in front of them. When he said, "Go and love one another," they saw it right in front of them. When he said, "Forgive one another," they experienced it and they saw it right in front of him. And now we see also that he rose from the dead, that this is not all that there is. And so these men no longer were prideful. You begin to see the rest of their life, they lived a life of humility and of serving of other people in love of Christ. You saw them no longer hiding behind locked doors, but they opened those doors and they went out into the world to go and share these colors and these true beauty of Jesus Christ, the love of God. In fact, one of his followers later on wrote a letter, and it was a beautiful, fantastic letter that he wrote. We call it simply, we just named after him, John. It's 1 John. And so later on, John wrote to a group of people telling them about the beautiful color of God through Jesus Christ. And so in 1 John 1:1, he says this. So John wrote, "We proclaim to you the one who existed from the beginning, whom we have heard and seen." In other words, what he's saying is, we heard him and we saw him. We saw the living Christ right there in front of us. He was there. Our eyeballs saw him. We heard him with our own ears. And we saw him with our own eyes. And not only that, but we touched him. Put his hands in his sides and put our hands in his nail wounds. And so we did it with our own hands. That he is the word of life. That everything about life and meaning and purpose and everything that there is all about this man who has loved them. And he goes on in verse 2, he says, this one who is life itself was revealed to us, and we have seen him. And now we testify and proclaim to you that he is the one who is eternal life. He was with the Father, and then he was what? Revealed to us. We saw him. But here's the thing that he says. Even though we saw him, and we experienced him, he opened our eyes to see something more grand and more beautiful and what life was really meant to be all about. And that is that life is found in Jesus Christ. That life is found in his love for us. That life is found in his goodness towards us. That life is found in our relationship with him. It's not about trying to get him to manage our life and try to get him to do all the things I want him to do. That's that old way of gray thinking, that I'm the center of the universe. What they found out was the goodness of God was God himself. In fact, this is exactly what John goes on and says in the very next verse. He says, we proclaim to you what we ourselves have actually seen and heard. Belaboring it, right? To make the point that they were there, they saw it, and it changed everything. And so we saw all these things and we proclaim it to you so that you may have what? Fellowship with us. Okay? That the beauty in life to all its fullest is when we are in relationship with each other. That's what gives us the most vibrancy of life. Vibrancy of life is friendship and relationship and joy together and shared life together. But it's not just about you and I. It's about us and our relationship with God. As he goes on, he says, and our fellowship is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ. This is the vibrancy of where true color lies. This is the lens by which God desires for us to look at life, no longer in the grayscale way of thinking, but looking it through life through the lens of Jesus Christ and all his color, which is of love, and the way that he loved us. In fact, he goes on in the next verse, in verse 4, he says, we are writing these things, why? So that you may share our joy. And our joy is found in this relationship with this God who loves us. He is, in all things, our true color. He's the one who gives us sense about life in all its fullness because we've seen and experienced his love. He also gives us a sense that this is not all that there is in life, that there is eternity, that there is reality of the eternal gift that we have in this relationship with God forever and ever that gives us great joy. Now, one of the things I just want to encourage you guys with is to have this understanding and to know that this same love that pursued these disciples, even though they were prideful, is the same love and the same person who's pursuing you. And the same love that pursued a group of guys who ditched them and ran away is the same love that's pursuing you. And the same love that pursued these guys all the way to the cross is the same love that's pursuing you and has pursued you all the way to the cross. And this same love is the one who came into the door of those disciples behind those locked doors is the same love that is coming to you. God's love for you is eternal. It is immense. It is everything that he always wanted you to desire and to know and experience, because that's where your joy comes from, your fellowship and your relationship with him. My hope for you this morning is that you don't just walk away on this Easter morning thinking, it's nonsense. I don't believe it. And continue your life in fear and anxiety, pride or shame and go on in life looking through life through the lens of grayscale and miss out on the vibrancy and the true colors that God is offering you. As we end our time here together, I want us to sing a song. If you've never heard this song before, I just want you maybe to even just listen to the lyrics. But if you've heard it before, please sing along. This song reminds us about the vibrancy of God's love for us and how much He loves us and that He continues to pursue us with that love. And He will go through anything and do anything to pursue and have a relationship with us. That is how much our God loves us.